The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Sick of the dark ways, we march to the drumming. Jump when they tell us that they want to see jumping. Dad, I want to see some fist pumping. Rip something, take back what's yours. Say something that you know they might attack you for. Cause I'm sick of being treated like I had before. Like a stupid standing for what I'm standing for. Like this war's really just a different brand of war. Like it doesn't cater to rich and a fan.
All right, guys, welcome to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm your host, Charlie McGrath. It is 9-11, Tuesday, 2012, and we have a really great program lined up for you tonight, even though right now I'm trying to connect via Skype with two co-hosts, Eric Lovney and Vinny Eastwood, and I'm having some issues getting connected with them. So let me get the lineup for tonight. If you're not in chat, please get in chat. It's the whole two-hour program. We're going to talk about not only 9/11, but where we've come in this 11 years. You know, where the nation has been led. And where the planet has been led, and what's happened to freedom, and what's happened to our country, and what's happened to the world in this just over a decade time period. Like I said, Eric Lovely, he'll be joining us here momentarily, hopefully, as well as Vinny Eastwood. And for the program tonight, we have Karen was able to get Susan Lindauer. She's an incredible woman, a very brave woman. Who has all kinds of information to share with us tonight, and an unbelievable story of what the foreknowledge was of 9/11, and what the post knowledge was of 9/11, things that were well known and tragedies and atrocities that could have been prevented that were not, and so it's going to be a good program. Get into the chat, wideawakenews.com. Click on that second tab that I'll pick in the chat and join into the program tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to not waste a bunch of time with a big long rant, even though I have some economic news that came out today that I certainly want to talk about. I'll save that for a video for later on. Let's bring on our guest, Susan Lindauer. Susan, are you with us?
I sure am, and I'm so glad to be on your show tonight. This is a funny day for me. For those of your guests, or for those of your audience who know who I am, I'm the former CIA asset who covered Iraq and Libya at the United Nations, and my CIA handler told me about the whole 9/11 conspiracy, airplane hijacking, strike on the World Trade Center. We talked about the use of explosives in the building. All through the summer of 2001, we're going to talk about that tonight. And so for me, I get really introspective on 9/11 because when the government decided to close debt, to deceive you, to lie to the whole world, I was in the way and I had to be destroyed. So I ended up getting, to sum up my story in 30 seconds, we'll talk about the whole thing at length, but I then got arrested on the Patriot Act, and I was held under indictment for 5 years with no trial. This is the very first presidential election that I have not been under indictment. This is just extraordinary. I feel like I've been liberated all over again because I can talk without threats. The last time John McCain and Barack Obama were in contest for the presidency, I was being threatened nonstop with being sent back to prison with no trial, no guilty plea, no hearing. But the government was so desperate to shut me up and to stop me from talking on the radio at that stage that they were trying, they were, we'll talk about all that. We'll talk about elections and what they did to try to fight me. But, I just want to say, sorry, I'm like going off on a tangent.
No, that's
all right.
That's fine. I'm done with it. No, I find when we have a guest on that have as much to share as you do, the best thing I can do is shut up and listen. And that's exactly so we're going to cover all that stuff. We have 2 hours in. I'm still having trouble getting
hold. These are all the, please jot down a few things because I really want to talk about the presidential elections and what I went through. I don't want to talk about it first. I should save that for last, but, I want to make sure that we talk about that because, it really shows the violence and the desperation and the savagery that they employed to try to stop the truth from coming out. And, especially with the elections coming back through again, I guess what I want to say is that in my life today, you know, 12 years later, or 11 years later, I have a lot of what ifs. Where would I be if I had lied?
Yeah.
You know?
Will I
9/11 changed my life forever because of the price that I paid for refusing to keep my mouth shut. And they knew that I was going to talk and they knew what I was going to say because I was an asset and I had been, supervised very heavily and they knew that their lies were going to be blown to smithereens. Exploded. So.
Right. Susan, let me cut you off for 1 second. I want to introduce you to, Vinny Eastwood. He's joining us as well. He is actually in New Zealand. He's an alternative media superstar. I'm going to make him blush now. In New Zealand, and I was on his program for the last hour of his broadcast, and he's joining me tonight on mine. And I told him who my guest was, and he naturally wanted to come on and be part of this as well. So Susan Lindauer, say hello to Vinny Eastwood.
Hey there, glad to be on with you tonight.
Glad to be on with you too, darling. How are you?
I'm doing great. I tell you, I am feeling better about the public's understanding about 9/11 than ever before. I think that, 9/11, we've reached a critical mass. I really do believe this. I believe it's very important. It certainly changed history and it changed, the war on terror, but we're breaking through. The government has tried to create something from 9/11. They've created this fraudulent security state. And I think that our knowledge is beating them back. And I think that ordinary Americans, more and more, even if they don't have all the specific knowledge that we have, I think that more Americans and more of the world community now see that the war on terror is a fraud. And the loss of civil rights what we were willing to sacrifice at the start of 9/11, Americans are no longer willing to put up with that. And so I think that we are winning, even if only 15 or 20% of the public is really fully educated about the specifics.
Well,
what do you guys think?
You don't need 20% or 10%. I mean, if you have a look at most of the successful revolutions throughout history, and ultimately that's kind of what a lot of people are saying, but I don't want revolution because that just means to go in a circle. I want some freaking evolution. I want to evolve past this kind
of
scumbaggery element, we want to keep everything as they are. We want to maintain establishments. Frack your establishments. Everything that has been built up around us is now and always has been since birth irrelevant to our way of life and the way we want to live it. It has only served as a leech, a cancer, a parasite on the freedoms and liberties of all people. And these events, like 9/11, bold as they are, actually serve as tools for us to wake up other people. Because it is so in your face, it backfires on them.
Yes, it does. Yes, I like that. Because, listen, under the Bush administration, after 9/11, I mean, here in America, there was such a culture of fear. There was such a, I mean, I realize that this audience that's listening right now, first of all, you're international. There's this, these are the awake Americans. And I understand and I respect so much this particular audience because, and internet audiences overall, internet radio audiences have been the first cutting edge on whatever your political stripe, whether you're conservative or progressive, they are the most awake. They're the first to get the facts and cutting edge. And I respect that so much. And so, you know, I know that we have always been prepared to, there are some of us who have always been prepared to defend America. But even then, I think that we're reaching a critical mass and we're taking these ideas into the mainstream as well. And I 8 years ago, the public was so afraid of George Bush. The whole country was just so savage, vicious. Remember just being terrified, not because I'm a frightened kind of person, but because I just, you know, they were constantly threatening to take me to prison. They
Let's, Susan, I want to get into all that. And in fact, we're going to take our first break of the two-hour program tonight. And when we come back, let's take it back to the beginning. Let's take it back to your handlers and what they knew. We're going to be back with Vinny Eastwood of the Vinny Eastwood Show and Susan Lindauer in 3.5 minutes. Hang tight. Guys, welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. Our guest tonight is, here we go. I was just going to say, I couldn't get a hold of Eric Lovely, and I just saw him jump in. So we have a full panel here. We have Eric Lovely, our co-host on Tuesday and Thursday night. He's joining us from an undisclosed location. We have Vinny Eastwood joining us from New Zealand. And our guest of honor, I guess, is Susan Lindauer, who is a CIA whistleblower. There's no other way to describe it. And, Susan, I want you to say hello to Eric Lovely because he's joining us now as well, and he'll be with us the next couple hours as well.
Hey, Eric, I'm glad to be on. I'm really excited about my experience dealing with internet radio, too, and you guys are with the radio. This is the format that's breaking past the corporate media blackout on all issues. And
it's so critical
what you guys do.
Yeah. And so, Charlie, you and I had a conversation specifically about this. You said there was some kind of a study that was done in the United States that if you go out and try and report something yourself, you're like 17 times more likely to break the story than you are if you go to any established media and ask them to cover it for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's got to go through a checklist. Eric, are you with us?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, good, good. I saw that you were joined in Skype. I wanted to make sure you could hear and we could hear you.
What's up, Eric?
Hey, Vinny, what's going on?
The gang is all here. Let's get into it. Susan, give us your background pre 9/11. What you did. Who was, you know, basically, who were you working for? And the reason I'm going to do this is because, you know, we do have the full 2 hours tonight. I definitely want to build the history of Susan Lindauer.
Well, I want to say that the reason that you guys, that the world did not hear about my story much sooner, even though you're all your audience, if you're new to my story, are about to discover how relevant it is at so many levels, is because the corporate media deliberately deceived you. And it was because of the internet radio that I was both saved from prison, saved from political indictment, political prosecution, and the truth was finally told to you, to the public. It's worth noting that the New York Times had this confirmation back in 2004, 8 years ago, and they deliberately stifled it because they decided the public would not be able to handle it or you would not be mature enough, I consider it very insulting. But we tried so hard to get this information to you, and it's not like I waited for 10 years and finally decided to talk. It was that first we had to try to go through the corporate media, and I was stymied by my indictment. So that's what I need to say first off, is that I didn't deliberately withhold this for 10 years. I was blockaded by the government, by the Justice Department, by the courts, and by the New York Times and all of the corporate media that should have been helping you guys. You should have been giving this to the public.
Well, it's still not being, the truth that we're going to expose here is still, you know, it's conspiratorial. You're a nut. You're a tinfoil hat if you believe that our government had any foreknowledge of the events of 9/11, correct?
Yeah. But, of course, the public is – let me start by saying the truth goes – Schopenhauer had a great quote that truth goes through three phases. And this is a good segue into my story. Truth goes through three phases. First, it is ridiculed. Then it is viciously attacked. Then it becomes self-evident. And it is considered self-evident. And that's what's happened with me and with 9/11 in Iraq. So let me take you back to what really, let me start by telling all of your audience what really happened. And I know that on this day of all days, it is important to give, you know, to give respect to the facts. First of all, I was the CIA back channel to Iraq and Libya at the United Nations. My dealings were always with senior diplomats on the Security Council level and ambassadors. And I had worked for years in this capacity. Everything that I did was overseen by handlers for the CIA and Defense Intelligence. In fact, I had twice as many meetings with the Defense Intelligence Agency as I had with the CIA, because the CIA was not supposed to be operating inside the United States, and so the Defense Intelligence Agency had a lead role in our efforts because it was domestic. Okay? So I had probably 800 to 1,000 meetings with the United States intelligence agencies, and I had about 150 to 170 meetings with Iraq and Libya, each country, because I'd go see both on each time I'd go to New York, I'd see both. So if you were looking at which side dominated, it was 4-1. And 4-1 for the United States. And I was having, you know, or 3-1. Let's say it was 3 or 4-1 to the United States side. And that becomes significant because when they decided to shut me up, they tried to say that I was an Iraqi agent. They refused to give me a trial. And I was like, well, of course you can't give me a trial, because if you give me a trial, we're going to show that I was meeting four times as often with the United States
than you were with the Iraqis, and we'll get into that. And eventually, and I believe in 2009, they had to dismiss these charges. The Susan, Eric, Vinny, hang tight. We're going to take our sector break. We'll be right back with more Wide Awake News Radio in 3.5 minutes. Hey, guys, it's Charlie McGrath with Wide Awake News Radio and WideAwakeNews.com. In 2007, 26 million Americans were on food stamps. 2012, the numbers exploded to over 46 million people relying on the government to put food on the table. Debt's out of control across the planet, pushing us towards a financial Armageddon. Talk of war seems to fill every newscast. And disasters, both man-made and natural, seem to be on the rise. Can you think of a better time in history than now to be prepared for the unexpected? Guys, I want to introduce you to our new partners in alternative media. BuyEmergencyFoods.com. BuyEmergencyFoods.com offers the best kind of emergency food, Legacy Premium, with the largest variety available in the freeze-dried food industry. Each meal is packed for freshness in an individual nitrogen-flushed Mylar pouch. The meal is then sealed in a stackable heavy-duty plastic container that's easy to store, easy to transport, and won't be damaged by water or rodents. So if you're worried about food inflation, economic crisis, unemployment, natural disaster, then don't delay. Prepare your family now. Visit our new partners in alternative media, buyemergencyfoods.com. Give them a call at 888-543-7345, or again, visit them at buyemergencyfoods.com. Guys, welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm Charlie McGrath, your host, joined by co-host Eric Lovely and special guest host Vinny Eastwood. And our guest is Susan Lindauer, CIA whistleblower, who was telling us before the break that, you know, pre-9/11, she was an asset that was handled by the CIA, and most of her meetings were between Iraq, but the majority of them were meetings with Americans in the defense industry and government institutions. And that's kind of where we left off with your story. We're trying to paint a picture of what was known prior to September 11th and then go forward from there to preventable atrocities that have happened not only to freedom on this planet, but to these nations that we currently have military presence in today. So, Susan, please continue with your story.
Well, I really wanted to emphasize that because the focus of our work for all these years was anti-terrorism. The reason that I was in dealing with Iraq, terrorism was foremost on our agenda because though our work was clandestine and covert on the U.S. side, the Iraqis and the Libyans were told from the first meeting that I had been asked to do this by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they knew they had a choice. They were informed up front that what we were seeking was terrorism intelligence, and that even though the war, you know, they were both pariah nations, they were isolated in the international community. However, given the seriousness of these, the rare, and you have to remember, even after 9/11, there's been no more terrorist attacks inside the United States. Before 9/11, worldwide, there were only 200 to 300 real authentic terrorists who truly wanted to take down U.S. symbols worldwide, okay? And that would include, you know, Carlos the Jackal, and that would include, you know, Abu Nidal and all of the big guys. There were very few people. Abu Nidal did more than 200 operations, and he was, and Ahmed Jibril, and these guys, there were not thousands and thousands of men doing this. There were a handful, and those handful of people needed to be watched. And the best sources of intelligence came from Iraq and Libya because they were the ones who would know what these guys were doing. And so, you know, I was never a novice on terrorism. Terrorism was my specialty. These guys all knew me. I mean, all these I knew them and they knew me. My bona fides before 9/11, I gave advance warning about the 93 World Trade Center attack, advance warning about the bombing of the USS Cole. I did the Lockerbie negotiations with Libya. Before 9/11, I was doing the preliminary talks on resuming the weapons inspections with Iraq's ambassador at the United Nations. After the bombing of the
Susan, might I ask, what's the backstory on that Lockerbie one? Apparently the terrorists who said that, oh yes, we're from Libya and we admitted they did it, were actually paid to do it or something like that, or they retracted it?
Well, what happened was Libya had nothing to do with it at all. I had done the Lockerbie negotiations. My CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, had been in Libya, in Lebanon during the hostage crisis. The Terry Anderson, Terry Waite, Jerry Levin from CNN, the Buckley CIA station chief, who was tortured to death. These guys, these guys had done, my handler had been involved in anti-terrorism for 30 years. And by the time we get to 9/11. And so we knew what we were doing. We were not idiots. We had fabulous contacts. I mean, if these countries needed to pass intelligence to the United States, I was the designated person to get it. Now that's really important for why you gotta understand that to understand why this whole thing with Iraq was such a skanky, kinky, ugly. I mean, the words I'd like to use, I can't use on the radio.
I like to use, in lieu of more commonplace sobriquet, the word scumbaggery.
Scumbaggery, what? He says. He likes to use the word scumbaggery.
Like a scumbag.
Okay. They act in a manner that would connote scumbaggery.
Scumbaggery, yes. I'll tell you that, but it's important because we were not novices. My defense intelligence handler was involved in exposing Oliver North and Iran-Contra. Okay, he appeared at critical moments to move Iran-Contra out of stalemates. Every time there'd be a block of information, it would be Paul Hoven who'd push it through. Paul Hoven was involved with the Project for Military Procurement, which exposed fraud in the defense industry. Mm-hmm. The $10,000 toilet seat, the $300 screw, all of that. Paul Hoven was one of the key players in that. Richard Fuse was involved in Lockerbie. The true story of Lockerbie was the CIA infiltrated heroin trafficking out of the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon during the Civil War. The primary source of funding for the Lebanon War between Islamic Jihad and Israel was heroin trafficking and hostages. They had taken 96 high-profile hostages, and the CIA, there was a rogue agent in the CIA who began to take kickbacks from the illegal kickbacks, dirty kickbacks, from the, and these were very important people on the U.S. side who were doing it. George Bush's name has been circulated. Oliver North's name has been circulated. These are some very powerful people that I was warned would someday come after me if they ever got a chance, and that they are ugly, mean-spirited people.
Well, so that must have meant that when Bush was running for an election, you must have actually been more terrified than most of them actually maybe winning.
Oh, yeah.
In 2000.
Oh, yeah. I was, and my CIA handler was very anxious that we should be, that when George Bush Jr. won, he was very anxious that to be conciliatory towards the Bush administration. So all of my dealings were very... My second cousin was the chief of staff to George Bush, Andy Card. And so from the start of the administration, we have two things going for us. We have my second cousin is the chief of staff, so all of my reports are going straight to the top of the White House. And we have cumulative experience of 30, 40, 50 years between all of us. We have done the best work in anti-terrorism going back decades. And I'm very proud of what we had done. Let me finish this. We knew how to recognize, actions and configure scenarios to identify upcoming terrorist threats. And we knew exactly what to do if something was coming. Okay,
all right, we're
going to pick it up. We are not novices.
I think you made that really clear. I mean, you're
okay,
all the way back
I'm
to Iran-Contra.
Yeah, I gotta. Right. I just want to say that because when we come back, we're going to talk about what happens with 9/11.
Very good, Susan Lindauer. Hang tight. We're going to be back in 3.5 minutes.
Make a promise. Take a vow.
Welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm Charlie McGrath, your host, Susan Lindauer, Eric Lovely, Vinny Eastwood. We're talking what we knew when we knew it, and Susan Lindauer was giving us her background and her credentials, and it's obvious that, you know, she spent years prior to 9/11 as an asset for the CIA, and they knew very well the terrorist situation of a few hundred people on this planet. So, Susan, please continue.
Before we do,
right now we're going to start talking about what was known prior to 9/11, and then what transpired from that point.
But before we do, sure. I'd like to speak to that point about credibility as well, and how much of it Susan has being the insider whistleblower that she is. But at the end of the day, you just look at 9/11. You don't have to have any credibility to know that something's awry. I mean, go out to your barbecue, turn the grill on for an hour, then ask yourself two questions. Did the grill melt? No.
Yeah.
Did the barbecue itself and number two, did the barbecue itself explode into particleized dust?
And then collapse.
No. Okay. Ergo, 9/11 was an inside job.
There you go. Yes, I agree 1,000%. And it was something that required and in advance of 9/11, there were so many protocols in place, and the people doing this work, and I know I'm patting myself on the back, and that may not be, you know, ordinarily you're supposed to be a little bit demure and humble, and maybe I'm not sounding humble enough, but I really want to emphasize to everybody, we knew what to do. We knew how to do it. We had in order for 9/11 to happen, there had to be so much interference to stop the natural protocols from going through, because there's a whole, you know, there's like, you can set things in, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
You can set things in motion very easily, and if you make a few right moves, and we already knew, everybody knew what they were, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, trigger mechanisms that set into place a motion of activity that protects the country from terrorist attacks. And all what we're going to show you right now is that all of those things were done. So let me just start by telling you what we did. First of all, I received, now having given you this lengthy opening, I learned about 9/11 in April of 2001 when my CIA handler summoned me to his office. He told me that he had a message that he wanted me to deliver to the Iraqi government through my very high-level diplomatic contact at the United Nations, at the Iraqi embassy at the United Nations in New York. And these people were used to receiving messages from me. I was accustomed to delivering them. So when I came and told them something, we had a procedure that we followed whereby they knew, you know, I was not a stranger to these people. We did this all the time. And in fact, we'd already been doing work on the USS Cole. We were in the middle of a different project, which was to get the FBI into Baghdad. So we had already solved the 9/11 problem. Uh-oh. If the Bush administration was serious about stopping the 9/11 attack, the Iraqis had already agreed to allow the FBI to send a task force into Baghdad because at the time of the USS Cole in October of 2000, which is only 11 months before 9/11, the Iraqi government had been forced to deport a couple of Saudi nationals when it was discovered they were conspiring to bomb a port facility in a different part of the Arab world. The Iraqis were very clear that they could not make arrests on their own because it would be an international crisis. It would provoke a response. They couldn't deal with that. The only thing they could do was to send deport the people immediately and notify them through the United States through my back channel, which they did. And two weeks before the bombing of the USS Cole, I personally notified the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency that the Iraqis were warning about an attack on the port in Aden, Yemen, and Then I turned around and went back to New York and notified the deputy ambassador of Yemen, who was a friend, personal friend of mine. Do I sound like a religious maniac and a crazy person who doesn't know how to do anti-terrorism? Oh, heavens no. We did it, and we got the information, and the night of the Yemen attack, they pulled the guard off, the standard guard off the USS Cole, knowing the attack was imminent. They pulled the guard doing duty and pulled back all the protocols for protecting the ship so that the attack could occur, because the reason was the Saudi group was Al-Qaeda, and they had a intention, which was to set up a presence in Yemen for launching attacks on Saudi oil fields. The United States allowed the USS Cole to be bombed because we wanted to use that as a pretext. We knew it was going to happen. We wanted to use that as a pretext to force the Yemeni government to cooperate with USS anti-terrorism initiatives. And so before the USS Cole was ever attacked, I personally sat down with my friend, the deputy ambassador of Yemen, at the United Nations in New York, and we had dinner, and I talked about with him about how this attack was going to occur and how the Yemeni government had better start thinking fast on its feet, how they were going to cooperate with the United States. Okay, this is a year before 9/11.
Hold on a minute, Susan.
But at the same time, we go to the Iraqis. Sorry.
Susan, I'm curious, before we go any further, you're delivering this information of an imminent attack. It's going to happen. You're hearing this from your sources from Iraq, and you're delivering this information to your handler and in other case, the deputy ambassador from Yemen. What is their response? What are they telling you? Thanks for the information. Have a nice day.
Oh, no, no, no. They were very anxious about it. They put the information. This is what I'm saying to you. We had a channel of communication that went straight up to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon was alerted. The Pentagon made a decision that they would pull the guard off the USS Cole so that the attack could succeed. By deliberately allowing the attack to succeed, they then created a pretext that would force the Yemeni, I'm showing you an example. This is a real life example of how the United States manipulates terrorism for other extra advantages. Mm-hmm. And in this case of the USS Cole, the advantage was that the United States, even though we had to suffer the attack on the USS Cole, the United States was then able to force Yemen, to compel Yemen to allow the United States to set up clandestine covert teams inside the country with great authority to do terrorism investigations and to move around the country attacking Al-Qaeda at will, citing the USS Cole. Okay, this is before you get to 9/11, a year before. At the same time, I was instructed by my CIA handler, before George Bush comes into power, I was instructed to go back to the Iraqi government at the United Nations and tell the Iraqi government that that since Baghdad could not arrest terrorist suspects when a conspiracy was discovered inside the country, the United States demanded, a year before 9/11, demanded the authority to send an FBI task force into Iraq with authority to conduct terrorism investigations, interview witnesses outside the presence of the government, and make arrests as required, as we deemed necessary. Now, in February of 2001, Iraq agrees. This is the very start of the Bush administration. So from the very beginning of the Bush administration, now remember, we're going to go to war over Iraq's failure to cooperate on 9/11 and its implicit involvement in the 9/11 attack. Garbage, garbage, garbage. And in fact, the situation was very different. Iraq had already agreed to allow the FBI to go in. So in April of 2001, they'd agreed from the end of the Clinton administration, from the first days, the first 2 weeks, literally the first 2 weeks of the Bush administration, this was a done deal. So in April of 2001, this is the context, in April of 2001, sorry, my CIA handler summons me to his office and he says, I have a message for you to deliver to Baghdad. They're already used to getting messages from me and they're used to responding very quickly. So he says to me, Susan, I want you to go tell the Iraqis that we are demanding any intelligence that they have on airplane hijackings and or airplane bombings. And if Iraq discovers this intelligence and fails to give it to us, and it's discovered that they've withheld it, then we shall go to war, we'll attack them, we'll bomb them. So at this stage, in April of 2001, Iraq has been a very positive respondent for many years. So I go up on the question of terrorism. Anytime I ask them for something, they're very cooperative.
Of course they were very positive and cooperative because the alternative is, hey, you're not going to get any food for oil program no more.
Yeah, yeah, and they'd been
yeah, that's
under,
right. That's absolutely, absolutely.
You know, we're talking about the death of like 100,000 plus kids because of this policy. And let me speak to you earlier.
No, we're talking 2 million.
We're talking about...
Two million.
And just before we go to break, I wanted to make this one point, Charlie, real quick. Standard operating procedure, SOP, whenever the defense forces or anything go outside standard operating procedure, that's when you know for a fact that something's up and something's going on in the inside behind the scenes.
All right,
that's right.
Good point, Vinny. Hang tight, guys. We're going to take our long break. We'll be back in about 8.5 minutes with Susan Lindauer, Eric Lovely, I think he's there, and Vinny Eastwood. Hang tight.
Let that show. My brother had a book he would hold with pride. A little red cover with a broken spine on the back. He hand-wrote a quote inside. When the rich wage war, it's the poor who died. Meanwhile, the leader just talks away, stuttering and mumbling for nightly musical play. The rest of the world watching at the end of the day, both scared and angry like, what did he say?
All right, guys, welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm Charlie McGrath, your host. It is 9/11, Tuesday, 2012, and we continue our conversation with Susan Lindauer. And I want to announce, if you're not in the chat room, please get in there. I'm going to try to do a better job this hour of monitoring for questions in the last hour of the program. Joining me on the panel is guest host Eric Lovely and special guest host, it's like the FBI, agent and special agent, special guest host Vinny Eastwood. And, of course, we have CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer. But, Susan, before we kick it back to continue the events just prior, we've made it up to the events just prior to 9/11, the attack on the coal, the knowledge it was given. I want to kick it over to Eric Lovely for a minute. We didn't have a lot of time in the first hour and he to get him on, and he's got some questions, especially the involvement or the CIA and their involvement in a questionable activity without a doubt. And he took some of these questions, and I want to give him the opportunity to pose them to you. So let me kick it over to Eric Lovely. Eric Lovely, take it away.
Oh, well, first let me say, you know, thanks for being here. But, you know, there are some real questions because you're dealing with the public. And being that you are basically a CIA operative, which, you know, you're not an agent. In other words, you don't carry a certificate and walk around, I guess, in their office as an actual CIA agent. But what we're looking at is an operative or in-country performance of duties for the CIA. Now, with people who are awake
and directed, yes.
Okay, with people who are awaking and who are coming into true knowledge, and now that I talked about the story for a long time, we continue to talk about the George Bush, but the Bush family really in whole, and how, you know, Hillary Clinton is a Bush, we know that Obama is a Bush, we know that Dick Cheney is a Bush, we know that all of these people are Bushes. We also know through congressional record and documentation who the Bush family is and how their entire fortune comes from Nazi gold, that they're basically Nazis. They, you know, infiltrated the country and was laundering Adolf Hitler's gold in the early 30s in the attempted coup behind Smedley Butler. The prosecution of the Bush family disappears for one reason or another. And then you continue to have Bushes in the White House and so forth. As a CIA agent and being, you know, you're attached to this word called intelligence. How do you deal with people in the public who come to you when you're talking about credibility and inside jobs? I mean, how, as a CIA agent who should basically be intelligent and know who they work for, how do you spend all of those years doing such good work as less than 0.1% of the CIA does, and the other 0.9%? I mean, well, the other 0.9% is this year alone. You have almost a dozen planes downed all across the world. They're all CIA planes. They're all packed to the gills with cocaine and heroin. They're all traveling into the country, okay, into the United States. The CIA is bringing them in. You know that the if you follow the CIA back to its birthplace, it comes from a conglomeration of Joseph Stalin and some other individuals during World War II, and we could get into that. I did a whole show on it. But how do you deal with people who are seeing this knowledge and saying, well, if we who are no one knows who the CIA really is, how did you spend so many years in the belly of the beast and not know what it was?
Oh, I did know. I did know what they were. I believed very passionately that, first of all, I have to tell you, I hated the first Gulf War. And I was horrified, really angry at the sanctions on Iraq. And the sanctions destroyed education, healthcare. 2 million human beings died from the sanctions. I don't care if they're foreigners. I don't care if they're Islamic or Jewish. To me, it doesn't matter. You don't get to tell me, not you, I don't mean to say you like I'm challenging you, but that it's wrong to kill 6 million people in the Holocaust, but it's acceptable to kill 2 million people in Baghdad. I don't care. I used to tell everybody, I don't care who's doing the killing. I don't care who's doing the dying. It's wrong, and I'm going to do anything that I can to help stop it. So they knew, the CIA knew up front that I would harass my handlers all the time about the abuses of Iraq and how the intelligence community and the media, the corporate media, the punditry, was lying, overwhelmingly lying, fabricating nonsense, garbage stories about the Iraqis, and ignoring the tragedy. If there had been an internet, you know, there was a young internet. See, this is the thing. We've progressed and evolved so much. It's fantastic. But we started in the mid-90s with the internet, just like 95, 96 is when it was just starting to come to the public. And we've progressed so much. But you know, if the sanctions had been, if the media, if the internet had come 10 years sooner, and the maturity had level had been reached so that the blogs were in full force, they never would have been able to do it. Because the media, the internet media, if it had come 10 years sooner, would have stopped them. I would have been able to go to the internet media. There would have been somebody to listen to me, to help me get this story out of what the, of, so that we could confront and defy the corporate media. My whole life, my career as an asset has been an irony that the corporate, that I wanted to get information to the public, and even as an asset, I wanted to get more, better information, better quality information to the public, but the corporate media refused to cover what I knew, and then degraded my reputation, though I don't care, but they tried to destroy my reputation. They said I was incompetent, that I was a lunatic, that I was a crazy religious person, and I do believe in God. I realize there's a lot of atheism today. I don't care. It doesn't affect me one way or the other. It just so happens that I do have a very strong faith in God and the universal force of justice. But
Eric's question, you know, and I want to follow up on Eric's a little bit. I mean, did you understand how insidious, the CIA
how insidious
was?
The CIA is? Yeah. Oh, yes. I understood that, for example, I mean, the irony was that my CIA, my team of Richard Fuse and Paul Hoven, now my guys were really good guys. Paul Hoven outed Oliver North, but I understood Iran-Contra. Paul Hoven today would be considered a traitor. If Iran-Contra broke today, Paul Hoven would be arrested and thrown in prison for outing Oliver North and showing the heroin the cocaine and heroin trafficking and the Iranian arms sales, even though it was so reprehensible and destructive. He would have been sent to prison by the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency for exposing the fraud and defense waste in the Pentagon budget. Because we have got this crazy notion of national security where you're not supposed to tell Americans the truth anymore. But fortunately, I was part of a team, a very tight team, and Richard Fuse and Lockerbie was all about how the CIA was importing heroin into the United States straight into Frankfurt and London and New York, the major hubs of Europe and the United States, so that they could profit and fund their black budgets.
Mm-hmm. And what's been happening here, I believe, in Afghanistan, the Taliban had completely wiped out all heroin trafficking. It previously had been like 70% of the world supply, dropped down to 1, and then boom, US invasion right after 9/11, perfectly justifiable, and then it goes up to being 90% of the world's heroin supply again.
That's right. I put this in my book. It was down to, in Afghanistan, the last year of the Clinton administration, year 2000, it was down to less than 150 tons of opium production every year in Afghanistan. A year after 9/11, as of 2003, the start of 2003, it had risen to 3,000 tons of opium, and by the end of the Bush administration, it was 8,000 tons of opium production.
All right, hold it there. We're going to take this break. When we come back, I'm going to kick it over to Eric because I think he had another question. We're going to be back with Eric Lovely, Vinny Eastwood, and Susan Lindauer in 3.5 minutes. Hang tight, guys.
He's like the cool kid at Pizza Hut.
Hey, thanks for the plug for Pizza Hut, Eric Lovely. Welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm Charlie McGrath, your host, Eric Lovely, Vinny Eastwood, Susan Lindauer. Eric's got another question, and then I want to get back in to the 9/11, what we knew beforehand, and then take it forward to what the United States and the world looks like after a decade of the Patriot Act and this global war on, air quote, terrorism. But let me turn it over to Eric real quick, so he can get his question in. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, it being a question, it's more of a statement. It's an education point where I want people to look, and I want you to understand that, like, we have today with us a wonderful lady who really put a lot into her work. All of her, you know, the efforts and things that she did were based on good results, good intentions, you know, wanting to come to a certain point where good things happen. But I want you to understand the Fabian Marxist. For every one there is of her, there are 15 or 20 agents that will work off every smile that she generates, every good feeling that she creates within a nation. They're going to come in and they're going to use that on behalf of a central banking system. This is what they do. They give you a little bit of good to do a whole lot of evil. They tell you a little bit of truth, just enough truth to get you in trouble. And that's really the way I look at it. As her role in this grand thing, that's what she represents. She represents that little bit of good that's put out front as window dressing, so that while she made good contacts and things within these nations, you had nothing but other teams of agents coming in, trafficking drugs, trafficking little children, trafficking, you know, grown people, trafficking the national resources of those nations and things, because it just seems over time all the way back.
Like a Patsy.
Yeah, like back into the 40s that we've been doing this, the Iran Shah, you know, we can go over and talk about the Shah and all the things
definitely.
That we've done.
I agree with you. I agree with you. The thing about Iraq and Libya was because that my opposition to sanctions was so great that I personally wanted to, I felt that I had to do something to stand, ironically, to stand against the values that you are describing. And my contribution, and it was a funny thing because I was definitely co-opted by the Clinton administration, that it was my opportunity to get in there, to get into the room and to push dialogue and diplomacy and to try to make a difference to stop the suffering in Baghdad particularly. It was not that I ever thought that the Clinton administration was doing a good job on Iraq. I was horrified by it, and it was very discouraging, but at times, but I still felt that the need for dialogue was so profound that if I left, there would be nobody to do it. And so it's like I went in and I started, and I thought it would be a short job. It would be, you know, it would be a short stint doing this, and it would take maybe a year or 2 years. 8 years later, and I mean, the Iraqis were begging, you know, begged me to do it. That's the other side of it is, you know, Libya and Iraq were very, you know, when they first started, when I first approached them, Libya's response was, "Oh, thank you, CIA." The Mr. Amara, who was a senior diplomat, roared with laughter. He couldn't believe. He said what I was proposing. He was like, "Oh, thank you, CIA. Thank you, CIA. You're going to help us get rid of our sanctions? Why, we're so grateful to you. On behalf of Gaddafi, I say thank you." And he thought it was, and they couldn't, they didn't believe me. But when they saw, as they got to know me, they realized that I really was sincere and I was really trying to do good things. And the Iraqis were the same way. They were like, "You've got to be kidding if you think we're," the first reaction was, "You've got to be kidding if you think we're going to deal with you. We would never deal with you. You think that, you know, we're not fooled by you for a minute." But then they saw that I really deeply cared about sanctions and I'm deeply anti-war. And so they saw that there could be advantages to them as well. And for example, when they went to the Lockerbie trial and I pushed them to accept the trial, but I also pushed the CIA and really beat the crap out of the CIA to my CIA handler to release the information to the defense counsel so that they would have a shot at a fair defense, which forced an avalanche of information to be released, which showed that Libya had nothing to do with Lockerbie at all. And that was because of my work. So I, again, it's like I was not always popular with the CIA.
Susan, I'd like to just mention two things here. Firstly, it turns out that well, you look at all the previous CIA directors and what their previous jobs were before becoming CIA director, and it's something like 8 out of 10 of the previous, 9 or 10 or 20 odd CIA directors or whatever, came straight there from Wall Street. And that's basically what the CIA's job is, in an overarching sense, is to keep the U.S. economy in check. And that's what the black ops is about, and all the excess heroin trafficking, to pour the liquid cash into the economy so that it can be propped up. Now, on top of that, we have a question from the chat room, and I think it's a very poignant question because it's rarely asked. Who do you think, in your personal opinion, with your experience, actually pulled off 9/11? Who would you hold responsible?
Well, I believe that 9/11 was a cover and deception operation. It was.
Susan, we're
going
to have to hold on a sec.
They used the hijackings as a front.
Susan, hold on one sec. We're going that great
terrible
question.
Terrible timing. I'm sorry.
Terrible timing. Great question. Terrible timing. We're going to take our second to last break, but we're going to start the next segment with the chat room's question, which was, who do you believe is really behind the 9/11 bombing? We're going to be back with Susan Lindauer in 3.5 minutes. Hey guys, it's Charlie McGrath with Wide Awake News Radio and WideAwakeNews.com. In 2007, 26 million Americans were on food stamps. 2012, the numbers exploded to over 46 million people relying on the government to put food on the table. Debt's out of control across the planet, pushing us towards a financial Armageddon. Talk of war seems to fill every newscast. And disasters, both man-made and natural, seem to be on the rise. Can you think of a better time in history than now to be prepared for the unexpected? Guys, I want to introduce you to our new partners in alternative media, BuyEmergencyFoods.com. BuyEmergencyFoods.com offers the best kind of emergency food, Legacy Premium, with the largest variety available in the freeze-dried food industry. Each meal is packed for freshness in an individual nitrogen-flushed Mylar pouch. The meal is then sealed in a stackable, heavy-duty plastic container that's easy to store, easy to transport, and won't be damaged by water or rodents. So if you're worried about food inflation, economic crisis, unemployment, natural disaster, then don't delay. Prepare your family now. Visit our new partners in alternative media, buyemergencyfoods.com. Give them a call at 888-543-7345, or again, visit them at buyemergencyfoods.com. Welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. I'm Charlie McGrath. It is 9/11 Tuesday, 2012. We have Susan Lindauer, and I'm not going anywhere other than the question that came into the chat room because, as I was telling the guys during the break, we're an hour and a half into this, and this is the, you know, this is the meat of it, being as it's the 11th anniversary of 9/11, and our nation, our planet has changed so dramatically since that event. And the question came in from the chat was, Susan, who was behind 9/11? Who was the ones orchestrating it? And now I'm just going to shut up and turn it over to you, Susan. Go ahead.
Okay. 9/11 was done by us. And I know the word that statement frustrates even members of the 9/11 truth community because they don't want to hear the word us. We did it. Okay? And by we, I know that it is not the people of New York. I know that it is not all members of the CIA. Definitely not. However, it was done by the Americans. We did this. I was told in April of 2001 to threaten the Iraqi government. When I came back from my first meeting with the Iraqi embassy about this, I soft-pedaled it to the Iraqis. My CIA handler said, "So, what happened when you threatened the Iraqis?" He wanted a debriefing on it, on their reaction. I said, "Well, I didn't really threaten them. There was no need to. They're very cooperative. They said they'd be happy to help us. If they hear of anything, they'll let us know." He said, "Susan, that's not what I told you to say. I want you to go back to New York, and I want you to deliver the message exactly as I have communicated it. This threat originates from the highest level of government, above the CIA director and above the Secretary of State. Now, that can only be three people: the President, George Bush, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And that was the way that I was ordered to communicate the message. So who did this? We knew about 9/11. They had already made a decision that they would bomb Baghdad harder than they'd ever been bombed before, back into the Stone Age, if 9/11 happened. Throughout the summer, now the whole preface of this story is how we had extensive work in anti-terrorism. I don't want to go into that again. I'm giving you guys a different perspective than I usually give on 9/11, because I want you to see how 9/11 fits into the context of all other terrorism, like the USS Cole and the 93 World Trade Center attack in Oklahoma City. We always know, people, it would never happen that we couldn't know this. We do know it. We have too many contacts. There's too much technology. If something's going on and it happens, it's because they deliberately chose to let it happen. That makes it our responsibility. Right there. Okay, now, in addition to that, throughout the summer, June, July, and August, my own handlers and I are talking about it in terms of a nuclear, we always believed it would be airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center, and there would also be explosives involved. Now, to be specific, we talked about a potential nuclear bomb, because we always knew that the whole scenario always involved bringing down the towers. And so in our minds, we associated the act of bringing down the towers, the airplanes would have to strike the towers, and there would also have to be an explosion that would be so phenomenal that it would have the power and the capability to bring down the towers. And so we talked about it in terms of a nuclear, miniature thermonuclear device. However, I bow to Richard Gage, who's done superior research, that it was actually a nanothermite explosion and a series of nanothermite explosions. That's entirely consistent with what I'm saying. The point is that throughout the summer, we expected both. It was never a situation that we were told about that was only airplane hijackings. It was always a mixture of explosions and airplane hijackings. It's just that nobody wanted to tell you that. But I remember having conversations in June and July over the phone, because we wanted the NSA to pick up on it. We would say, hello, NSA, we're talking about a major terrorist attack. You better be paying attention. And we would get on the phone and say, and I would say to Paul Hoven, my defense intelligence handler, where are they going to get the bombs? We weren't worried of the airplanes. We were going to get that information from Iraq. But I said to Paul many times, where are they going to get the bombs to bring down the towers? And he said, well, you can get them from any military storage facility on any military base up and down the East Coast in driving distance to New York City and the World Trade Center. We always knew it would be the World Trade Center was the target. We always knew there would be explosions. And so I want to clarify that, because some people think that because I am one of the people who believes there were airplanes. There were shenanigans with the airplanes, and it was what we call a cover and deception operation. It was like a magician's trick. They used the airplanes because they knew you would look at the airplanes, and you would, in your minds, you would see cause and effect. Oh, the airplane hit the tower. Oh, the tower collapses. Therefore, the airplane fire brought down the towers. Well, obviously that's not what happened, and we knew that even before you did. We knew that throughout the whole summer, that it would require an explosion. And so we were debating what type of explosion throughout June, July. Now, let me tell you very quickly, because we're coming to the end of the show, or not to the end, but I got to tell you this. In August of 2001, again, we're not incompetent. We're not stupid. My CIA handler, on August 2nd, I can tell you the day, it was Robert Mueller's Senate nomination hearing. And I was on the phone from my office in Silver Spring, where I was a consultant, and I was on the phone with Richard Fuse, and I was saying that I thought Robert Mueller, who was nominated to head the FBI, was going to throw this terrorism investigation. And we were already debating, and I was already pissed off about it, that we were like, Robert Mueller is going to throw the investigation to help out the politicians. 9/11 was 6 weeks away, and we were already convinced that the choices being made were hurt, were going to cause this investigation to be compromised. And Richard said to me, well, gosh, what happens if there's a, what happens if this attack occurs before his confirmation even goes through? What if there is no FBI director before the attack occurs? We were both like, oh man, they better hurry this up. They better get him in there. You know, somebody, we better have an FBI director before the 9/11 attack. And I was like to Richard, you mean you think it's imminent? And he said, oh yeah, the attack is imminent. And I was like, well, I better go up to New York and check my trap lines with the Iraqi government and, you know, see if my diplomats have got anything, if any words come in from Baghdad. And he, and Richard was like, oh no, don't go to New York. It's too dangerous. And he said, and I said, well, I have to go. I've been bugging the Iraqis all summer. I've got to find out if they've heard of anything. And he said, well, go up and come straight back. Don't, do not spend the night. Do not stay for the weekend or, you know, stay into next week. He said, get up there and come straight home. And I want to see you in my office on Monday morning. I want you to tell me what the Iraqis said. Well, of course, the Iraqis' reaction was,
hold on a minute,
we don't have anything. We have...
Hold on a minute. I want to get the Iraqis' reaction when you came back after being warned. Don't go to New York because it's known full well there's an attack imminent. But we're going to take our last break of the program. We'll be back shortly. Hang tight. Welcome back to Wide Awake News Radio. You know, it's just so convoluted. I mean, Eric and Vinny and myself were talking after the break. Unfortunately, Susan's on a landline, so we couldn't continue the conversation with her. Just so convoluted, so confusing. You know, my basic question is, and I know you're going to tell us, you went and checked your trap lines in New York and to find out if the Iraqis knew anything about it, and I want you to continue with that. But, you know, in this last, we got about 10 minutes left, you know, at the end of it, I'd love to know, is it a group of individuals sitting across the pond that hatched this plan that we knew of all along, that we just allowed to have happen, or did we launch this plan, put it in the hands of others,
yes,
and facilitated the attack? Go ahead.
Yes, yes, to the second. Yes, to the second. Mohammed Atta was a CIA asset. If there were any hijackers, if there were any indigenous hijackers, we
right.
identified them, we created them, we find, it's like the FBI does with all the other terrorism attacks. Since
yeah, now they do it, now they do it.
They're all fake attacks. They're all fake attacks. And the FBI recruits some dumb, mixed up kid, you know, some unstable individual and tries to get them to do something, and that's exactly what they would have done on 9/11.
Boy, that's a great point, because if we look now at what they're doing with domestic terrorism, right, the five, Cleveland Five, that were going to blow up a bridge, we find out it's FBI lured in patsies, but please continue.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what would have happened with 9/11 as well. And let's just remember that Mohammed Atta called his father the day after 9/11 and told him he was still alive. So I don't know that we're ever going to know who was on those airplanes. I do believe there were airplanes involved. There were shenanigans with the airplanes. Let's put it that way. That's maybe an even better word, and it is very convoluted. This was a government that was absolutely hell-bent, determined to force a war with Iraq. They already had the Patriot Act in the bottom drawer, ready to come out. They had planned a military, big, huge boost for the military-industrial complex, and they had concocted this wild strategy for how they were going to force this government, to force the whole country to accept a major military national security priority, a fascist priority. This is the expertise of the Bush administration. You said Bush family, forget the administration, the Bush family is fascist. That goes back to Nazi Germany. And they are so corrupt and so dirty and ugly. This is how they think. For us, it's impossible to imagine that anybody could be so cruel and vicious and savage. But I will tell you that, you know, our efforts, that even if 80% of the intelligence community urgently wanted to stop 9/11, the other 10% or 15% could do so much mischief and damage and undermine and undercut the efforts to stop the attack. And what I said at the very beginning was that, you know, we have, there's a whole bunch of protocols that kick into place. And they're fairly easy to trigger. If you're doing, if the intelligence community is functioning properly, all these things naturally trigger responses and it goes right down the chain. So let me tell you what I did in August of 2001. First of all, the Iraqis threw up their hands and said, we don't know anything. The only chatter about this terrorist conspiracy is coming from the United States. You are the source of all the intelligence on this conspiracy. There is no indigenous Arab conspiracy that does not come back to you, first of all. And so I went back to Richard, that's what I told him. I said, they don't know anything. They're saying that we're the source for the intelligence. We're the source of the warnings. And everything is circling back to us. So Richard said, Richard and I on August 6th, which was the day of the presidential briefing memo when George Bush is at Crawford Ranch and he says, he throws a memo back at the CIA and says, you know, hey, you covered your butt, now let's go shoot some golf balls. And I'm in Washington with Richard Fuse and I am given instructions to telephone the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft. I am not a junior level person at this point. I have 10 years experience in anti-terrorism. Richard Fuse has 25 years. Paul Hovind has 25 years. I am designated to make this phone call because I have been in immediate contact with Iraq and Libya. And they know that I can get a response just from using those words, Iraq and Libya. That's going to trigger a response. I contact the office of John Ashcroft, his private staff, and I tell them that we are asking for an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies, everyone, immigration, FEMA, they give me the phone number for the Office of Counterterrorism and say repeat this message to the Office of Counterterrorism, and I do. We are asking for an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies. We expect a major terrorist attack on the United States with the potential for mass human casualties. We believe that it involves airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center, specifically identified. We expect explosives to be used, possibly a miniature thermonuclear device. You know, and we're asking for any fragment of intelligence to be pushed back to us as rapidly as possible. I'm told that John Ashcroft said, those CIA people, they're always crying about this stupid attack. Forget it. But the staff of John Ashcroft gave me the number for the Office of Counterterrorism, and I called them, and I told them the same message. They did put out an emergency broadcast alert, and that is why the FBI in Minneapolis, of all places, who, again, they're way out in the American heartland. They're not tied to the Beltway. They're thinking of America. They have just intercepted Moussaoui coming in from Canada, and they notify everybody, the Secret Service, everybody gets this warning. The air traffic controllers, everybody is notified of this potential terrorist attack that he's allegedly involved in, involving airplanes. which, gee, did the FBI in Minneapolis just think of this themselves? No, we were already talking about it. We put out a request for it, and they fed back to us. But, again, John Ashcroft's office refuses to let the FBI in Minneapolis do its basic job, which is to open the computer of this expected terrorist, even though Washington is screaming by this point that it's about to happen. Then, the security cameras at the World Trade Center record strange nightly activity from August 23rd to September 3rd, where vans are seen entering the World Trade Center. They're captured on video in the parking garages, and they stay from about 3 o'clock in the morning until about 5 o'clock in the morning. They were able to distinguish that these are separate markings, separate types of vans other than the janitorial trucks, which had already left the buildings by about 2:30. So this was an anomaly. These vans had never been in the World Trade Center before, and after September 3rd, they are never seen again. And they were doing something.
Yeah.
It has been speculated they were taking out the gold, or they were putting in the opportunity.
Like the opportunity to me. And I wanted to kind of round off the show with a bit of a joke. You know how we all like to have a few laughs because, basically, if you don't, you've got friggin' none. Dick Cheney. This will be his 11th year doing so. He celebrates 9/11 every year, the anniversary. He goes out and he buys presents for his family. He sets up a big cardboard replica of one of the towers in his living room and drapes a few Christmas lights around it. You know, it's lovely. Next to the fireplace, a few chestnuts roasting on nanothermite. You know, that kind of thing. And one year, the lighting around the tower actually shorted out and it caught fire. But it didn't collapse.
But it didn't collapse. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that Richard Gage is correct. It's a very convoluted operation. It took a lot of work to do this. And that's why, even though it is primarily, the outside evidence is negligence. From the outside, what you're seeing is repeated missed opportunities which prove negligence over and over and over again. There's command failure to make easy decisions to stop the attack. But even more than that, once you cross the line and start putting bombs, explosive devices, into the towers, then you've gone from a failure to preempt the attack, obviously, to a deliberate, and it is convoluted. It's crazy that they ever could have done it. But it fit the overall agenda of this insane, and it's insane.
Yeah,
it's insane.
And the fact is, if we look at, you know, and certainly with about 30 seconds left, we're not going to have time to get into it. And Susan, I'll definitely get you back on, because the whole reason for talking about this event, 9/11, 2001, 11 years later, is the dramatic change the world has seen. Now, a lot of people have been saying it's coming for a long time, but since over the last decade, we've seen the evisceration of freedoms in this country. We've seen the expansion of the military-industrial complex, the expansion of the security-industrial complex, the nonstop waging of war in the name of keeping us safe from terror-loving terrorists. And the truth be told, you know, this absolutely, without a doubt, seems to be nothing more than a contrived event in order to implement this new control apparatus and turn us into this fascist regime. Guys, I want to thank you very much for hanging out tonight. Susan, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming out and having the courage to share this information. Eric Lovely, thanks for hanging out for 2 hours. Vinny Eastwood, thanks for hanging out with me for like over 3 hours, man. I greatly appreciate that. Guys, enjoy Jeff Rintz because he's coming up next. We'll be back tomorrow night. I hope everybody has a good rest of the evening. Thanks for tuning in tonight. And, it's a very sad occasion when we have to sit 11 years after the fact and consider the fact that our government seems to be completely complicit in this horrible event. All right, guys, have a good night. We'll see you tomorrow. Peace.